All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce D. Castle presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel. To my left is Judge Mormon. We're here today in the matter of Edison v. Locklear, docket number 092675. Counsel for the parties, please note your appearance for the record. Thank you.
The appellees represented by Michelle Architina.
Okay.
Michelle Apple, Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
No.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Carpenter, do you wish to reserve?
I would reserve 10 minutes, Your Honor.
10 minutes. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Edison Locklear. The issue in this case is whether the Board can use the implicit denial rule to preclude the VA's obligation to adjudicate the referred issue of a total rating based upon unemployability, commonly referred to as TDIU.
So is it limited just to that referred TDIU issue?
The record does reflect that there are two referred issues, the referred issue of TDIU and the referred issue of pension. And I believe that both claims under the facts of this case are pending, although in this case the brief that was presented by the appellant simply address the question of whether or not remand was required because of the Board's decision relative to the pending claim of TDIU.
Now, you just referred to these issues as two claims, are they?
Well, I'm not sure they are, Your Honor. I believe that there is a single claim, and that claim was for the maximum rating available under law for Mr. Edison's May 1981 claim. And that these are, in fact, issues involved in that claim, both the question of extra scheduler rating for unemployability as well as for pension.
So TDIU, in your mind, is not a claim, but rather part of the rating?
No, that's part of the rating, Your Honor. That would be correct, as would the pension matter. The Board's May 1983 decision at the record at 2313 specifically referred the issues raised by Mr. Locklear and his representative of entitlement to benefits for individual unemployability and a non-service-connected pension. When the Board did that, the Board imposed a specific duty on the VA, which we believe renders these issues pending, and they have not been adjudicated. And as a consequence, the implicit denial rule would not be appropriate. There were, in fact, two subsequent decisions after the referral that was made by the May 1983 Board decision. Those were in February of 1986 in the record at 2120 to 2125, and the other was a VA decision in 1987 in the record at 279. Each of these decisions dealt with the issue of scheduler rating. None of these decisions dealt with the question of the issue of extra scheduler rating based upon unemployability or the issue of pension. Mr. Locklear, in all three of these...
Let me ask you a question about that. Why is that important?
Well, I think it's important...
That last fact.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I
stopped you and I went back.
Yeah.
The fact that these two decisions didn't deal with extra scheduler rating, why is that fact important?
Well, if you treat these as decisions that implicitly denied, then the question becomes, were they dealing with the totality of the matter that was initially raised? And therefore, you have to, at least as I understand the current analysis required, determine whether or not what was done in February of 86 and August of 87 did or did not put Mr. Locklear on notice about the disposition of these other issues. And I apologize because of the difficulty in the way in which the documents refer to this as claim versus issue.
No, that's fine. I mean, I think we all understand that there are interchangeable words here. But considering the concept that we just discussed a minute ago about the TDIU issue being part of the general rating, why is it that the extra scheduler matter makes any difference at all if there was this decision on the rating?
Because the board recognized that these were issues that were raised by the appellant and his representative, and that these issues needed to be adjudicated and developed by the agency of original jurisdiction, and directed that those matters be returned to the VA for that process. Therefore, the board's decision in May of 1983 simply isn't final, though it has been treated by the VA as a final decision.
But doesn't the implicit denial rule apply to claims, not to issues?
Well, and I think that's what makes this case factually distinguishable, because...
Well, the answer
Oh, the answer to the question is yes, Your Honor. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go over that. You are absolutely correct that as currently construed, the rule of law about implicit denial has been focused on claims and whether or not there are separate claims.
Wasn't that discussed differently in Tyrus? Didn't they talk about the idea of a claim being broad when it came in and the secretary being able to break it apart?
Yes.
And in this case, the secretary broke out TDIU, specifically broke it out, sent it out, referred it.
As they did with
that. And then you had a request for increase come out after the board decision at 2280. You had notice go out to them regarding your request for increase. You also had the pension notice go out. You also had a separate hospitalization go out, which is broken out, decided differently. You had a decision letter talking about your continued 10%. You had the increased deferred rating. You had the claim for benefits. You never had another increase in August 84 documentation. You had another notice with regard to increase at 2222 in September of 84, again in December 84, deferred rating talking about increase. Then you had a general compensation letter going out. Not sure how broad that one went. I've noticed. Then you had an increase with a confirmed rating. You had another confirmed rating, all dealing with the nervous condition, talking about an increased rating. You had an NOD to that increased rating. You had a statement of the case to that increased rating. And then you had the board decision regarding the increased rating.
In February of 86.
So the question becomes, was your client on notice with regard to TDIU being decided in any of those decisions, including the board decision?
Absolutely not, because there was no decision. There was no adjudication. And part of what defines pending claim, as used in the definition at, I think it's 3.1p, they do talk in terms of claim. This case presents the question of within the claim, when there are in fact multiple issues identified specifically by the VA and acknowledged as having been raised by the appellant and his representative, isn't the VA under an affirmative obligation to take specific adjudicatory action? And they didn't.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Carpenter, with regard to that particular point. In the RO decision of November 2006, there's a statement made that says, you did not file a formal claim for individual unemployability after this matter was referred to the RO.
Correct.
I take it that you take issue with that statement.
Well, in terms of the formality, I'm not sure there was a formal claim. What I do take issue with is the fact that that statement ignores what the May 1983 board decision acknowledged, which was that the issue was raised by both the representative and the veteran.
But when an issue is raised and there's an informal claim that results, isn't there a requirement that the veteran then formalize that claim? And isn't it otherwise abandoned?
And that gets back to the question I believe that Judge Hagel raised, which is, can we parse out the elements of or the issues of a claim and treat those as separate claims, or is there in fact one claim here. And the one claim here has not received a final decision. It has not been finally...
What claim is that?
For the appropriate initial rating to be assigned his disability, whether on a service-connected basis or on a non-service-connected basis.
It seems to me...
But I'm sorry.
Go ahead, please.
What rating... But you say the appropriate rating is not assigned, and yet you use the word claim. Now, before you told me that rating... was an element of a claim.
It is, and it's an element in the claim that was raised by Mr. Locklear in May of 1981. And that claim had, in this case, three specific issues. The initial scheduler rating to be assigned, which was initially non-compensable, and the board assigned to 10%. They then referred the issue of extra scheduler and pension. Both of those, pension...
referred TDIU, right?
Yes,
which would be extra scheduler in the grand sense.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor. And the reason that I use the extra scheduler is because there are various regulations to consider.
So you're looking at 4.16B as opposed to A.
That's correct, because he didn't meet the scheduler requirements at the 10%, but also there would be consideration under 3.321B for an extra scheduler rating. And in this case, the board in 1983 recognized that there was a pension issue raised. All three of those issues deal with the question of unemployability. The pension requires a total and permanent determination.
But we don't have before us anything with regard to the pension.
You do not. But what you do have is the question of what is the claim? And the claim here was what Mr. Locklear asked for in the first instance in May of 1981, and that was for compensation or entitlement to the payment of benefits to which he would be entitled to under law. The board in May of 1983, and that's what makes this case unique, recognized that the issue of pension was raised because a pension could pay him more than the 10% for the service-connected rating, so they could have kept the 10% service-connected rating and paid him pension at substantially higher rate and simply offset dollar for dollar the 10%.
Well, then there's an indication in that 2006 RO decision that there was correspondence that went back and forth with Mr. Locklear as a result of the referral of this TDIU issue, trying to get information from him, and I think also as regards the pension issue. And then the RO says, you did not file a formal claim for individual unemployability, nor did you submit a fully completed form, and therefore you haven't perfected this portion of the claim. Now, I realize that the law has since changed, and we deal with Rice now, but it seems to me that in part of your argument here, you're trying to have it both ways, and you need to explain to me why it is that TDIU is a separate issue that is capable of being broken out, and then if it's not pursued, why it's not subsumed into the rating that's subsequently made on the claim.
And the key to that is the action taken by the board in 1983. The board in 1983 created this issue. They acknowledged that the issue was presented, and they took the action of referral and sent it back to the agency for appropriate action. Now, the problem then becomes, was referral the appropriate action, or was remand the appropriate action? My research reveals that the extant law in 1983 was 38 CFR 19.145B, which provided for only three types of disposition by the board. Four types: allowance, denial, remand, or dismissal, in whole or in part. There was no such action here because it wasn't in whole and in part. they broke it out, and they should have remanded the issues instead of referred the issues. And what would have been the difference if it had been a remand? The next extant section at 19.146C expressly requires a resubmission to the board unless the benefits appealed are granted on review by the agency of original jurisdiction.
But didn't the board at that time say that they didn't have jurisdiction over this issue because it was raised for the first time before the board?
I don't believe they used the expression raised for the first time, but that it was raised and that it had not been developed or decided by the agency. And I have no problem with that, but the appropriate remedy under the extant law was remand and not referral, because remand has a much clearer delineated responsibility to the agency, which is grant the benefit or send it back to us.
But if the starting place is that the board doesn't have jurisdiction, how can it possibly remand? It can't remand that over which it has no jurisdiction, it simply referred it.
I disagree. It did have jurisdiction because those issues were in cohate with the claim made. Now, that is certainly an analysis that is part of this court's current jurisprudence, which probably was not the board's understanding in May of 1983, but that's part of the catch-22 game that's being played here by the board's use of the implicit denial rule. The implicit denial rule didn't exist when all of this was taking place. So what is happening here is that the VA is coming in and saying, well, we want to use the benefit of the implicit denial rule, which didn't exist in 1983, 86, or 87, in order to prevent Mr. Locklear's claim from being adjudicated.
Assuming it's a referred informal claim, doesn't the secretary have to then send a form?
And
doesn't the 1 year begin after that?
That's correct.
So now you could
My reading of the record, there was no TDIU application forwarded to Mr. Locklear that I can find in the record. And I did find in the record that there was a pension form sent and completed and returned, and I find no action ever taken on that pension form.
Of course, the sending of the TDIU form, if we're talking about an informal claim, would be appropriate.
Correct.
As you said earlier, we're talking about an issue, not a claim. There was a requirement to send this form?
Actually, I don't under this particular fact set. And that's why I think that it's critical for this court to address what the responsibility is of the VA when the board refers an issue as opposed to remands.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, if I could. You quoted the regulations that existed at the time of the referral or remand or whatever.
Correct.
Isn't that only an issue if we're talking about clear and unmistakable error, a revision based on clear? Why do we care what the regulations were at that time now? Because that adjudication, is over.
Well,
at some point, there was no appeal.
With respect, Your Honor, I disagree.
Okay.
That adjudication is not over because it never occurred. What the VA is trying to do is to ring a bell that was never rung.
Again,
there was no adjudication of the issue of TDIU or the issue of pension.
Okay.
Those issues were referred. The reason that I reference that is to put it in context as to what the legal significance is and the fact that the board in 2009 did not address it. The board in 2009 made favorable findings of fact that this court, under its jurisprudence, is bound by, that there was not one, but four informal claims for TDIU of record, two that preceded May of 1983 and two that were after May of 1983.
Actually, didn't they refer to them as implicit claims?
Implied claims, right. I believe, was the language that they used,
yeah,
Your Honor.
And can you define implied claim for me?
I'm not sure. Well, there is an inferred claim under this court's case law in EF. I am not familiar with the notion of an implied claim unless it's merely a variation on the inferred claim. And the inferred claim under EF would be, as occurred here, a claim that was reasonably raised by the evidence or statements of record.
And I can't enlighten you on that.
Could I ask you another question? What impact, if any, is the court's previous decision in this case? The court's previous decision.
I'm not sure I see any impact, Your Honor.
Okay. Why is that, from a res judicata standpoint?
Because these two issues are either pending and unadjudicated, or they're not. If they're pending and unadjudicated, then whatever happened in another proceeding that dealt with issues other than those issues would not be.
So if I understand your argument correctly, then you can have an issue that was referred and, in your view, not decided. And even though there's a decision by this court on the same claim, mm-hmm. then that issue floats out there forever until there's a decision on that issue. Even though you said that the issue is part of the rating.
That is certainly my view, but I will, just to make sure that I'm clear, I don't believe that this court's case law or the case law from the Federal Circuit has had occasion to address that question. And that clearly, in my view, that's why we're here, and I'm just expiring.
Is there any other questions?
No.
All right, thank you.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Michelle Russell Katina. I represent the secretary in this matter, and sitting with me at counsel desk is Nisha Wagel, who is deputy assistant general counsel. As counsel has recognized, the issue before the court today is whether the board, under the facts of this case, correctly applied what the Federal Circuit recently has termed the implicit denial rule. More succinctly, the issue is whether the veteran received notice by virtue of the agency action below that a claim for increase or total benefits based on unemployability was deemed denied. And it's the Secretary's answer that answer to these issues is yes.
Good. One thing that I'm trying to grasp here is the implicit denial rule was announced by the Federal Circuit relatively recently in DeShoto. And this court issued a decision in Rice, which sort of clarified the definition of claim and issue and so forth. Now, when do those cases apply? Do they apply retroactively? Do they apply only prospectively? And why?
Well, Your Honor, occurred to me that it seems that the case law wants to change the past. And
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
That the applying this case law is in essence trying to change the past.
So does that mean it's applied retroactively or only prospectively?
Well, as far as the definitions, I would say that they would apply retroactively.
So in other words, I guess to put it another way, well, no, that's fine. And why do you say that? What authority do you have to say that?
Well, it's elucidation. It's elucidation of the issues that are presented.
I'm talking about authority, not words. Some of the words I'm not sure I understand, but go ahead.
I think that that's... I'm not... I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor.
So back in 1983, when the board specifically broke out benefits for TDIU and referred it to the regional office, what was the law? Was that a separate?
No, it was not.
Okay. So.
Or it was. It was. At that time, yes.
At that time.
The TDIU was considered separate.
Considered
from,
a separate claim.
Yes.
So did the secretary ever send a formal application?
The record doesn't show that they did.
So. If that were the situation, and if we were to rule that it's not closed by these later decisions that never mention it,
that would still be open?
Well, it's the secretary's position that it's not.
Okay, on what I just suggested to you, if we ruled that it was not closed by these other decisions, which never mention it, would it still be open?
No.
Why?
Well,
Don't tell me because it got closed in these other decisions.
No.
Okay.
Shortly, well, I think that the record demonstrates that the veteran was never misled as to what...
I don't think that's what I asked. Yeah. I asked, did he get a formal application? You
no,
said no. So my question to you is, if it's not denied anywhere else, would it be remain open? Because he never got his formal claim and application, and he has 1 year after you mail it to him, per regulation.
But I don't think that the formal claim precludes adjudication of the issue, Your Honor.
I understand, but if we determined that it was not adjudicated in a subsequent decision, would it remain open? Because you did not send him a formal application.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming we accept your view that at the time it was a separate claim.
Well, I would have to still refer to the court's recent case law on that in 1994, when he was granted a total disability rating, he at that time, he could have pursued the matter of an earlier effective date back to 81-75, whatever the date he's has alleged, and he did not do that at that time. So the earlier effective date was foreclosed at that time.
Now, he did get a total rating, but is that the same thing as TDIU?
The effect is the same, Your Honor.
But is it the same thing?
Well, the TDIU is only meant to compensate the veteran for where the service-connected disability affects his employability.
Well, we're talking
where
about...
Where a total disability rating is not warranted or the criteria has not been met. So where the criteria has been met, there is no longer the need to assign a TDIU rating.
But for a substantial period of time in this case, the total rating, the 100% disabled rating for schizophrenia was not in place.
No, it was not.
And the position of the appellant here is that he was entitled to total disability for unemployability at an earlier time than that. And does just simply giving a 100% rating equate to TDIU under those circumstances, where we've separately broken out TDIU back in 1983?
Well, until he is afforded the 100% rating, no, it would not be. But in this case, the veteran consistently alleged that his service-connected disability affected his ability to maintain employment. And at each stage where an adjudication took place, he was only assigned a 10%. So under the case law in Ingram, he's effectively on notice that the disability rating that he is seeking has not been granted.
But when you issued the decision in May of 83, he was on notice that he got 10%,
right,
and TDIU was separately being considered. And then ever since then, you've considered rating schedule determinations.
Well, in February of 86, though, the board again noted the fact that the employability issue was part of the claim. And
where did they note that?
Well, you've got February 86 is 2120, Your Honor.
2120. And where do they say that? They noted that there was an assertion that it produced a definite employment handicap and that you were to look at 3102, 47, 4129, and 4130, none of which are TDIU.
And to follow up on that, in any of these decisions subsequent to 1983, did any of the board decisions refer to those sections of the regulations that govern TDIU?
Not that I'm aware, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, what was your answer to that question?
Not that I'm aware.
I mean, if you didn't take this out, if this was never referred out, we have the implicit denial rule. We have decisions of the board being affirmed by the court that say you didn't get a rating, you had knowledge, you could have raised these issues, et cetera. But since, as I understand it, VA took it out and said, it's over here. And all the rest of this stuff got processed, got appealed, ultimately 96 comes into the court, ultimately gets confirmed. And when we look at this record, we're looking at TDIU being something taken out by the secretary, which under Tyrus he can do. So where's the decision on TDIU?
But from what I understand, the concern in Tyrus, Your Honor, was whether or not the veteran was somehow misled by that separation. And this record does not show that this veteran was in any way misled. He constantly brought the agency back to the fact that he considered his schizophrenia to render him unemployable.
Well, in 80, the board decision you just rendered and all the other board decisions, no one's ever mentioned the TDIU, probably because it's being processed by VA.
And isn't industrial inadaptability part of the rating schedule for schizophrenia anyway? So wouldn't it make sense that he would mention that with regard to his seeking a higher rating for schizophrenia?
Yes.
I mean, I think what we're grappling with is that the secretary controls and processes these cases. And the secretary, through the board, independent board, broke it out, referred it to the RO. And there's nothing that you've pointed to or that we're looking at that got processed. As your opposing counsel mentioned, there's a pension. Information submitted, a formal application went out there, came in. We don't know where that one went either, but it's not before us. We have hospitalization broken out in the very 86 you're talking about, referred to the RO. We don't know where it is, but the point is the secretary can do that. He can take it off the plate. And once it's off the plate, how do you get back on by an implied on the plate? That's the part we're grappling with.
The bottom line, though, is whether or not the veteran has notice. And in this case, it is the secretary's position that he had notice at all times that his disability did not warrant greater than a 10% disability rating. The fact that it's been separated out, I think the record shows...
We have a doctrine. There's a doctrine called latches. Mm-hmm. And early on, the court said we're not going to apply that against a veteran. So if the veteran sat and didn't succumb to you and say, geez, you know, did you forget about my TDIU? I mean, our prior case law says we're not going to hold that against the veteran. It's going to be against the secretary. So in this particular case, you have entire documentation and nothing mentions TDIU after its referral.
And you're correct that the pension claim, but I think that... my reading of the record shows that they were considered abandoned, that because of his failure to complete the income statement and to submit the requested medical evidence, that in essence the claim was considered abandoned.
Which one?
Well, I think the pension and the TDIU or the unemployability issue look like that they had become interrelated by the RO.
What would give you that indication? Can you point to us?
Well, the notice to him that he had not, I don't have an exact page number, Your Honor, but the notice to him that he had continued not to supply the information that had been requested of him.
I thought, didn't the record cross that out and have a follow-on one?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't that notice crossed out and that a follow-on notice went to him saying it was still being processed? I mean, you're not citing me to anything in the record, but
yeah.
So I'm going on a big memory here, which could be wrong.
But didn't you already tell Judge Castle that your review of the record indicates that he was never sent the form to formalize his TDIU claim?
Yes, Your Honor. But that doesn't prevent the issue from being adjudicated, where employability or
I understand
that.
Yes. I just, in terms of formalizing this claim, your review of the record indicates that VA never sent the form.
No, only the net income and worth statement.
I have to take exception. You have a claim out there. We're never going to send you the formal one. We're never going to develop it, but we can deny it. I mean, doesn't that... Without even saying we denied it.
But as I said, Your Honor, I think that the bottom line is notice. And the veteran was at all times on notice that the employability issue, in his mind, from the statements that he made, had not been resolved. And he continually brought the RO back to that issue. And when rating decisions and the board decision were issued, he was told that his compensation level was not greater than 10%.
Well, if that's your position about notice, and it's because of all this exchange of correspondence, then it would seem to me that you would have to come to that conclusion at some point, and that that point wouldn't necessarily be in 1983. It would have to occur sometime later because of this back and forth discussion. At some point, I think you may have to, well, somebody might conclude, okay, enough's enough. This person knows about this, that this particular issue has already been considered by the VA and rejected, if we accept your position. So, you know, if we accept your position, at what point would you say that we could definitely say that Mr. Locklear had notice?
It's
because that has, assuming
that, that the unemployability issue had been resolved by the RO and he was denied.
Mm-hmm.
As I stated before, in the February 86 decision, they did again mention the employability issue and said that based on the severity that his
February
6th, February 4th, 1986, at page 2120 of the record.
So is that the date you believe that we could say definitely Mr. Locklear had noticed that this issue had been considered by the VA and a finding was against him?
Yes, Your Honor. There's also the May 85 rating decision that that said based on the hospitalization report that they had received that they continued as 10%. So,
and you don't think that would refer only to the fact that they also had a separate hospitalization claim out there? You think that covers everything in the world too?
The issue that he was, well, and your Uno.
He had an 82 claim for hospitalization. That's also Q. It's been referred to another one. He had an 84 claim for hospitalization. This referred to hospitalization, but now all of a sudden you're suggesting it told him that he didn't get TDIU. I mean, what I'm listening to is we're going to break it out. We're going to put it over on the shelf here, and you're going to be denied everywhere else without us ever mentioning TDIU, without us ever going through that analysis, and now we're going to hit you with the implied deniability. And I'm having a hard time with this one.
Let me ask you this question.
Yes.
At a number of points, he gets a disability rating assigned that is less than 100%. TDIU, at least under 4.16B, doesn't require 100%. And so how can TDIU be disposed of by these interim lower level decisions that say you're entitled to 10% or some other percentage without addressing his claim or his issue of TDIU at least under 4.16b. I understand fully that he could understand or be on notice that he didn't get 100%, and therefore he didn't get 60%, so therefore he didn't open the door to a scheduler TDIU. But an extra scheduler TDIU is a separate animal, it seems to me, within the VA. And it doesn't require any particular percentage of disability. It requires impact on the ability to maintain gainful employment.
And that's the issue or the claim that the veteran constantly made to the agency. And the evidence that he, or the medical evidence and the evidence that he submitted that he considered pertinent to that claim was shown to be considered by the RO and by the board in rendering their decision.
Let me add one fact, important fact. If this case had an 86 board decision and TDIU had never been broken out, it seems to me the secretary has an argument that everything was denied when this claim was denied. But under the facts we have here, TDIU was specifically broken out by the secretary, by the board referred to the secretary. And so that's the part that differentiates arguments that might be made with regard to whether a decision became final and closed everything, extra scheduler, TDIU under A or B, any higher rating, etc. But we took off the table, the secretary, I should say, took off the table TDIU. Now, how does it get back in there? It's officially taken off, and somehow you're arguing it informally got back in there. And that's really what I'm grappling with.
I understand, Your Honor. But as you know, and as I stated previously, I think that the concern, as I stated under Tyrus, was that the veteran was somehow misled. And I don't think that the record ever showed in this case that this veteran was ever misled. He constantly brought the agency back to the attention that his medication interfered with his ability to maintain employment. And we want to use the term TDIU, but I think even the 1983 decision just refers to the fact that he was seeking a total disability rating based on his inability to maintain employment or obtain employment. And that is, you know, what the, and as I stated, that's what the veteran consistently brought the agency back to. And each...
Yeah, but the 86 board decision, which I thought is what generated all this, the November 82 rating decision denied entitlement to temporary total disability benefits payable under 429. This issue has not been developed for appellate consideration.
In the May 83 decision...
I'm sorry, I got the wrong one, yeah.
The May 83 decision that referred this...
That's the one.
Speaking of actions leading to the present appellate status, specifically refers to a claim for benefits to entitlement to benefits based on individual unemployability. And that was referred to the originating agency for appropriate action. That's individual unemployability. They use those words. They didn't just say inability to hold a job or anything else. Individual unemployability, which has a unique meaning in veterans law.
But to the veteran, it means that I am not employable by reason of my service-connected disability. And when the 83 decision went back to the RO and they affected only the 10% rating awarded by the board, the veteran brought them back in his next statement. But I continue to be not employable because of my schizophrenic...
All right, let's go to the 86 board decision. There's no appeal at the time, correct?
Yes.
All right. So the veteran can seek a request for reconsideration.
Yes, Your Honor.
And when the board chairman gets a request for reconsideration, the board chairman does what? Says, oh, you're right, it was referred to the RO and hasn't been adjudicated? What does the board chairman say?
That's the remedy that the court stated in Jones, that the failure to issue an SOC should have been addressed by going back to the board and seeking reconsideration. And it's a procedural error, and I would say that the referral here in the 83 decision was also a procedural error.
But a procedural error that never got adjudicated.
That's not the Secretary's position, Your Honor.
Let me change the tack a little bit here. Does representation below make a difference in this case? Either by a VSO or by an attorney practitioner?
Well, I think if he had been represented consistently by an attorney practitioner, we probably would not be debating the issue. He was represented by a VSO at all times throughout, and it's the references made by the VSO that alerted the board and the RO to the fact that the veteran was not employable.
What effect does representation, if any, have on notice?
It's the reasonable person standard, and given that it is the reasonable person standard, I would say that representation would not be a factor. It's the Secretary's position, Your Honor, that the decisions that were issued in this case placed the veteran on notice that he was not being awarded any greater compensation than the 10% disability rating. And under these facts, the veteran should have reasonably known that any increase claimed by him based on his ability to obtain or maintain employability was denied. It would also be the Secretary's position that prejudicial error would come into account in this determination, because the veteran nor his representative have ever argued that the record in fact established entitlement to TDIU.
Yeah, but that's a hard one for an appellate court to find no prejudice on, isn't it? Facts that weren't found below. I mean, nobody's ever applied the TDIU criteria.
Except that they found that he did not warrant a 10% rating, any greater than a 10% rating, based on his industrial impairment.
So if we could find absolutely undebatable, no question that the board would have found that they didn't have TDIU, maybe we could do that.
As I said, Your Honor, it's the reasonable person standard.
For notice.
For notice.
All right.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter.
Yes, sir.
What was Mr. Locklear seeking when he said that he was not employable? What was he seeking? What benefit was he seeking?
Well, it's clear from the May 1983 decision at 2289 that the board in May of 1983 believed that he was seeking a total rating based upon unemployability.
Okay.
And I think...
If you're a claimant and you have a claim and you're hoping to get the highest rating possible, what would be the highest rating possible in this case?
Total rating.
So wouldn't make any... So if he's seeking a total rating, and when the RO or the board decides a 10% rating is all you get, why shouldn't he be on notice that his application for a total rating, regardless of the theory, has been considered and denied?
Because
and then take any action he wants.
Because of page 2 of the board's May 1983 decision and the record of 2289, in which they specifically referred that issue. And then, Your Honor, in the documents that were added to the record in the last week...
No, I know. They referred it to the RO, and the RO came out with a 10% rating. So if he's seeking 100...
On a separate request by him...
Now, originally, when it was referred back to the RO... The RO issued a decision, and that decision was 10% rating.
and all that did was implement the board's
decision. Well,
that's
what you say. Shouldn't that, even if it did, even if that's all it did, if somebody's asking for 100% and the board sends it back to the RO, and the RO then, regardless of, you know, what somebody thinks or what your or anybody else's characterization of that sending it back to the RO, and the RO issues a decision right afterwards and says 10%, and the veteran wanted 100%, and the RO says 10%, then why is he not, the veteran or Mr. Locklear in this case, on notice that he didn't get what he was asking for?
Because this is a veteran-friendly system that doesn't put that level of sophistication on a veteran. And this court in Ingram specifically referred to not imposing that level of sophistication. The jurisprudence of this court, as well as the Federal Circuit, has consistently said that pro se appellants aren't expected to have that level of
sophistication. With regard to claims, right?
I think, quite candidly, Your Honor, that's a distinction without a difference in this case.
Okay.
But I would also point out to you that following the May 1983 decision, the board wrote the director of the regional office on the same day that the decision was issued, and the letter directs the attention of the VA director to page 2, paragraph 1 of the decision for appropriate action at 2310. So the board didn't just take it off the table in its board decision. The board went out of its way to write another letter and say, we hope you notice the elephant in the living room.
Then why isn't that, if that's the case, and you think that's such a strong element, why doesn't the presumption of regularity apply to say, well, geez, if they issued a decision directing the RO to issue a decision, and referred it there, wrote a separate letter saying, hey, look at this, and they came out with a 10% decision, why isn't the presumption of regularity apply and say, well, geez, they must have followed the board decision?
Because it's inconceivable that they could have done the development to decide those referred issues between the time of the board's decision and the implementing RO decision. That's why I said all the VA did was to implement the RO's decision. On another matter, you raised the question, Judge Hagel, about retroactive application of case law. And I'm not sure there's anything on point relative to rules of law. However, there is a Supreme Court decision in Rivers v. Roadway that says that when a court interprets the meaning of a statute, that meaning is what that statute always meant. Now, I'm not sure that it is a stretch to apply that to rules of law, but I'm not aware of any case that stands for that proposition. The VA suggests that this is about notice and what notice they gave to Mr. Locklear. The VA never gave notice relative to any adjudication that they made for the question of TDIU. And that alone...
Take it out of this context.
Sorry?
Say we didn't have a specific referral of TDIU to the RO. Straight claim, came in, sought the maximum, and the board issued a decision and gave you 70%. And you didn't appeal it. And today, would that be implied denial of extra scheduler, of TDIU A and B?
I believe, based upon the findings made by the 2009 board decision, that there were four implied claims for TDIU.
No, I'm out of this case. I'm thinking in general. A new case. Somebody filed it. Wanted to see. Maximum benefits. There's unemployability evidence in the record. Did not appeal it.
I'm sorry, there was?
There is unemployability evidence in the record.
There is
not appeal it. Got 70%.
If there is cogent evidence of unemployability in the record, then Comer applies.
And Comer, who applies?
Comer versus Peek at the Federal Circuit applies because the cogent evidence reasonably raises it under Roberson.
And so it would be denied?
No.
It would not be denied. Wouldn't you have to go Q under Roberson?
No.
Raise it under Q?
No, because what Roberson held was is that the violation of the duty to assist was not Q, but the failure to act on evidence that was of record was, and Comer said that that was expanded to include facts outside of Mr. Roberson's specific circumstance. So I believe that the Comer, the rule in Comer would apply to a pending claim that was created by that evidence, because it's that evidence that puts.
Remember, this is not an appeal. Remember, this is with the facts I'm trying to lay out to you is a case that did not get appealed, not one that got appealed, and we sent it back for problems.
Right.
It was never appealed. And you're suggesting that Comer stands with the proposition that it remained alive?
Yes, because the VA ignored...
Do you have the site on Comer, Andy?
No, I don't, but I can certainly submit it.
I'll get it.
Let me see if I understand your argument, Mr. Carpenter, as to this point. I realize that we're, you know, arguing hypothetically here.
Mm-hmm.
But would you say then that in every case where the issue of the level of disability is at issue, that the board must address TDIU in all its forms?
Under Comer, if there is cogent evidence of the inability to work due to the service-connected disability or disabilities, the
and so without that kind of overt discussion of TDIU, you could not have an implicit denial.
Correct. And if it was reasonably raised, as I understand Judge Castle's hypothetical, was reasonably raised and ignored, reasonably raised by the evidence, but ignored by the decision makers, and later there is an award and there's an attempt to get an earlier effective date.
Doesn't Ingram say just the opposite? Doesn't Ingram say that a claim for TDI, if you get a claim denied, it implicitly denies the claim for TDIU? Doesn't Ingram say that? I mean, maybe it's dictated under the facts of the case, but certainly isn't that the example they gave? And the idea being that you came in for total benefits, and don't we have case law that says basically it's all generally one claim? I mean, we're going a little bit off. I just wanted to make the distinction between this isn't that case that we've been talking about.
No.
Our case, the Secretary literally took it off the table.
I have two quotes from Ingram in my notes. First, that the court concluded in summary that a sympathetic reading of the appellant's pleadings cannot be based on a standard that requires legal sophistication beyond that which can be expected of a lay claimant, and must consider whether the appellant's submissions, considered in toto, articulate a claim. So it seems to me that Ingram is entirely consistent with your hypothetical, Your Honor. Ingram also said that it concluded that the Federal Circuit has neither overruled the pending claim doctrine articulated in Norris nor created the general doctrine of sub salientio denials, which supplants the pending claim doctrine. So it seems to me, Your Honor, that it is a pending claim because it is reasonably raised by the evidence.
But the situation,
that is consistent with this court's decision in EF. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's all right. But the situation in Ingram was that you were dealing with two different claims under two different statutes.
That's
1151
correct.
Was one claim, and I can't recall what the other claim was, but two different claims under two different statutes. The assertion was made that a decision as to one implicitly denied the other. The Schodel was argued as the basis for that, and Ingram said, no, where you have two distinct claims, you under separate theories, separate statutes, you can't have an implicit denial because you haven't put the appellant on notice that you're deciding that other totally unrelated claim. Here,
go ahead and add 5 minutes, please.
Here what we're dealing with is a situation where under Rice, we're dealing with an element of a claim.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and that's what makes or compels this case to be before a panel, because we have a separate fact set from the fact set that was dealt with in Ingram. And we have the additional problem that claim under Rice includes the two referred issues. The problem here is that you can either treat this as a single claim, or, as the government suggested, you could treat it as separate claims. Either way, it seems to me that the analysis in Ingram has to apply, because what the government is suggesting is that...
But before you go further, I just have to read from 248 of Ingram. It's reasonable to say that an appellant who receives a disability rating less than 100% has notice of how his conditions have been raised and has the opportunity to appeal. Even if he does not have a clear understanding of TDIU, he does have a clear statement of which disability is being rated and the fact that the secretary is declared to be less than 100% disabling. So I think Ingram, at least you can maybe argue it's dicta, Ingram clearly laid out the proposition that these are impliedly denied, and if you don't appeal them, you're going to have to go back in and find Q or something else. But again, our case here, as I understand it, is it's taken off the plate.
Right. And with respect, Your Honor, I believe that Comer overrules that portion, whether it's...
Believe me, I will take a look at Comer.
I don't doubt that for a moment. I did have two more points that I wanted to make before I sit down. I appreciate the additional time. The government suggested that somehow the VA concluded or considered this or these issues to have been abandoned. The problem with that is that that is entirely contradicted by the fully favorable findings of fact made by the board in this case in 2009. The board made a finding of fact that there were four implied claims. Now, had the VA actually believed or considered these to be abandoned, then that would have been the position that they had would have taken and would have made appropriate findings of fact and pointed to the specific point in time in which they were abandoned, because there was actual notice given. This is a fabrication, a post hoc rationalization by the VA at oral argument to justify their position. It doesn't exist in the record. What exists in the record is the finding of facts by the board. The board said there were four implied TDIU claims, two before 1983 and two after 1983. Those claims were alive, and the board implicitly acknowledged that fact by then relying upon the implicit denial rule. I think that covers everything that I wish to say. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Any questions? The case will be submitted. We'll come to council.
All rise.